Mike, I know you've done this many times over during your career, you know, talk about your background and all that, and I think it would be an appropriate place for us to start here. Even though some of those listening have been fans of yours a long time and may know something about your life, there are always new people entering bodybuilding, and I'm sure they would like to know something of your past, anything you consider relevant or important.
You're right, Dave, about people entering this field all the time. As a phone consultant, I receive calls from individuals literally every day who only recently picked up a barbell for the first time, and which augurs well for the future of this industry, by the way. These novitiates usually know little or nothing about mine or the sport's past, and since my life is so intimately bound up in bodybuilding, relating my past may teach them something about the recent and not so recent history of the sport. Dave, I was born on November 15, 1951, in Germantown, a small town outside of Philadelphia. At the age of 2, my family moved to another small town in Pennsylvania, Ephrata, which was and is predominantly a farming community. My dad was the major influence during the first 12 years of my life. Although he wasn't intellectually oriented himself, he went to some lengths to inculcate in me the values of education and knowledge. When I did do well in school, for instance, he would reward me. There was one occasion when I received all A's in my report card, and he gave me a baseball mitt, and another one when he gave me a $20 bill. He started me out correctly, as now I am a proud and successful capitalist, except for the very beginning, the first day of kindergarten, when I locked my mother out of the house to prevent her from entering me into school at all. I did rather well.
You locked your mother out of the house?
Yes, Dave. I was a very shy child for a number of years. I spent much of my time alone at home, rather introverted, not accustomed to being around other children. So upon learning I had to go sit in a classroom all day with others my age, I rebelled. I'll never forget, as my mother walked out the door holding my hand to take me up the street to the first day of kindergarten, I all of a sudden bolted back inside and locked the door. It never occurred to me that she'd have a key, but my next remembrance of that day was my mother walking into the classroom where all the children were seated, carrying me wailing under her arm.
So your rebelliousness has a long history.
My rebelliousness? What do you mean by that, Mr. Prokop?
Well, I must say, Mike, a good part of your career seems to have revolved around questioning tradition, the establishment, and what so many merely blindly accept.
Yes, Dave, that's true. In fact, the first ad I ever ran in 1977 to sell my books, I advertised myself in bold print as bodybuilding's foremost iconoclast. Iconoclast means literally image breaker. While every other top bodybuilder uncritically, unquestioningly accepted the Weider-Schwarzenegger dogma, which had and still has individuals training up to 4 hours a day, I, upon hearing the truth as told by one Arthur Jones, discarded that junk immediately, and I've never sacrificed my view of the truth. Yes, Dave, I was a rebel, am a rebel, and always will be, albeit no longer blindly rebellious, as I was often in my youth. No, not a blind rebel. I now consider myself a radical for the truth. And if my telling the truth makes certain people angry, that's their problem. The truth is everyone's ally, whether each recognizes it or not. And if the truth hurts anyone, that individual is at odds with reality and is philosophically, psychologically in a bad place. I decided some time ago that I am not on this earth to win a damn popularity contest. Let me note here again that my father was a major influence, Dave. It was from him that I learned something valuable about integrity early on. My father, Harry Menser, who is now deceased, was someone who always seemed to find it easy to stand up for what he believed in. He reveled in it at times, boasting about his integrity, which had a way of irritating those of a weak-willed ilk. I responded rather heartily to my father's pride and self-esteem, which in part is why I am a staunch individualist today. I can remember people in my youth referring to the Mensers in a tone that inferred we were arrogant and conceited, but we weren't. We were merely proud of ourselves.
Mike, what about training in those early years?
In addition to emphasizing the importance of education, my father placed a very high premium on being physically able and strong. This resulted in a rigorously athletic first 10 years of my life, Dave. I had a reputation around my hometown, for wherever I went, I would run, jump to touch signs overhead and leap fences, literally all the time, especially jumping fences. There were times when I would jump fences seemingly almost all day long, looking for ever higher ones to challenge my ability, and I never missed, believe it or not. I had a remarkable leaping ability. I also swam very well, especially the freestyle, in which event I beat the best fellow on the community swim team after receiving a special invitation to try out. I gave up swimming almost immediately, however, as they had us swim so many laps in practice, I simply couldn't believe it. I truly was overwhelmed by the amount of work they expected. In looking back, I see that the coaches were grossly overtraining their athletes, as most trainers and coaches do today, all operating on the overly simplistic, childlike notion that more is better. I also did well in track and field, football, gymnastics, and baseball, but as soon as I discovered weight training at the age of 11, I gave up all other sports straight away. My early interest in weights extended beyond bodybuilding to Olympic lifting and powerlifting. My hometown, including the entire state of Pennsylvania, was influenced highly by the fact that the father of American weightlifting, Bob Huffman, operated out of York, which is only 30 miles from Ephrata. As a young teenager, a friend of my father's, Johnny Myers, who was a powerlifter, would take me on frequent visits to Musseltown, as York was called, to watch the nation's and world's best Olympic lifters, powerlifters, and bodybuilders train. I got the opportunity to spend entire Saturday afternoons at the then-famous York Barbell Club, watching men like Bill March, Tony Garcia, and the precocious Bob Benarski, our best ever heavyweight Olympic lifter, practice technique as well as challenge their personal bests in the press, snatch, and clean and jerk. Also, Terry Todd and Ernie Puckett, the first official champs in organized powerlifting, train on the bench press, squat, and deadlift. This had an enormous impact on me as I took up these lifts, the press, snatch, clean, and jerk, bench press, squat, and deadlift early on. In fact, they were the foundation of my training, and by the time I was 15 years of age, I pressed around 250 pounds, squatted 500 pounds for 2 reps on a free bar. By the way, I also got to see and talk to John Grimmick on a number of occasions. It was Huffman and Grimmick, you may recall, who launched Muscular Development magazine, which was and is my favorite, and now is the only one I write for exclusively, but is published by Steve Bleckman out of Ronkonkoma, New York, who recently changed the format to All Natural and is now called All Natural Muscular Development. In the beginning, Dave, I trained as the manual which accompanied the barbell set my parents gave me as a Christmas present directed, 3 times a week with about 10 exercises or sets per workout. It wasn't until I became a Muscle Magazine fanatic that I gave up a reasonably sane approach and started training 6 days a week for up to 3 hours per session. And as I wasn't making progress doing that, I assumed I'd have to train 4 hours a day, but wasn't sure at that point it was worth it. As I was working 12-hour shifts in the Air Force, working a part-time job, trying to spend as much time as possible with my girlfriend, the thought of training 4 hours a day wasn't very appealing. Just as I was about to forsake my dream of ever becoming a bodybuilding champion, I met Casey Viator, who introduced me to Arthur Jones, who introduced me to high-intensity training theory. During a 1-hour phone call, Mr. Jones disabused me of the notion that I was an expert on the subject, merely because I had memorized all of the top champs' routines out of Muscle magazines.
Well, Mike, tell us more about Arthur Jones.
Yes, an interesting subject for me. He possesses an unmitigated passion for the mind, especially mathematical exactitude, the likes of which I haven't seen since, Dave. The first time he and I spoke, it was on the phone, but not a conversation, rather a lecture, and with a capital L. After a very terse, almost abrupt introduction, he launched into an impassioned disquisition on the subject of the fundamentals of anaerobic exercise physiology. I was stunned, not just about what he said, which was brilliant, but more so how he said it. Something like Dr. Leonard Peikoff's description of his first meeting with Ayn Rand in her living room while he was only 17 years of age, this man, Arthur Jones, was willing to spend considerable time explaining to a complete stranger in the clearest, most objectively precise manner, the essence of anaerobic exercise science. Dave, it seemed like the fate of the entire world hinged on his summoning every scintilla of cognitive energy, wringing every bit of intellectual clarity possible from himself. And the reason he did it, in addition to enjoying the experience of achieving that level of intellectual precision, was because I was sincere, an intelligent yet ignorant and sincere 20-year-old. And as Dr. Peikoff also said about Ayn Rand, that he never expected to meet another individual again with the likes of her intellectual passion, I suspect I'll never meet anyone quite like Arthur Jones again.
That is one of the most insightful stories I've ever heard, both about Mike Mentzer and about Arthur Jones. Certainly unique. Well, Mike, thanks for sharing that. But now, what about Steve Bleckman? I know that you were a writer for Joe Weider for 20 years. In fact, we worked together at one point in the Weider office in Woodland Hills, as you recall. What happened? After 20 years, all of a sudden, you're off and working for Steve Bleckman.
I originally moved Dave to Southern California 20 years ago at Weider's invitation to write for his magazine, Muscle Builder, which now, of course, is Muscle and Fitness. The first few years, Joe and I got along extremely well. Not only did we work well together during that period, we socialized quite a bit, and as many who were there recall, he seemed to regard me almost as a son, believe it or not. Joe had a certain love for philosophy, as I did, so he finally had a top bodybuilder he could promote, who he could also talk to on a higher level, and promote me he did, Dave. There were as many as 4 and 5 of my articles appearing in each issue of Muscle Builder. I was appearing in his ads and was on the cover regularly. Then, in the aftermath of the 1980 Mr. Olympia, I vociferously protested in magazines and at my seminars that the contest was fixed for Arnold to win. This enraged Ben Weider, who talked about it to Joe, and apparently Ben's wrath rubbed off on his brother, and he eventually turned against me. Without belaboring it, Dave, our relationship, that is, Joe's and I's, hasn't been the same since. I perceived a further cooling off of Joe toward me several years ago, after Dorian Yates won his first Mr. Olympia, in fact. Dorian was very gracious at the time to cite me as his idol, and even credited heavy-duty, high-intensity training for building his physique. This was the first Mr. Olympia that Mr. Weider couldn't claim he had trained. At about the time that Dorian had burst onto the scene, I was reaching a creative pinnacle, and my articles in Flex magazine were received, with Dorian giving me credit and Heavy Duty receiving ever greater recognition and acceptance. I believe Joe thought that he had created a monster, a threat to his concept as trainer of champs. But to his credit, Joe still allowed me to write for him.
Mike, haven't you trained a few other top bodybuilders?
Yes, including Aaron Baker, David Dirth, Roland Kickinger, and David Paul, the barbarian of movie fame.
Well, how did they do under your guidance?
Extremely well, in fact, Dave. I got Aaron Baker interested after that first WBF contest, where he appeared in the worst condition of his life, having lost 25 pounds of muscle due to chronic, gross overtraining. He was following something called the Bulgarian system, which had him training for up to 1 hour 3 times a day. Very disheartened, he approached me one day and I explained the heavy-duty system. He signed up immediately, and within 6 weeks had regained all the muscle he'd lost plus some, going to an all-time high muscular body weight of 254 pounds, I believe it was. Aaron made progress, Dave, literally every workout for months and months, which aroused the very intense interest of his good friend David Dirth. David embraced heavy duty even more than Aaron, as he loved to train hard, whereas Aaron didn't. David made the best progress of his life, as this was when he put on considerable muscle mass and finally lost the image he had as the scrawny pro. David Paul was perhaps my favorite client ever, as he trained harder than anyone I've ever seen, including myself. David pushed every set so hard, one had the distinct impression he didn't care, literally, if he had pulverized his bones. He approached me a while back, complaining he hadn't gained any strength or muscle in 5 years while training for 2 hours a day, 6 days a week, sometimes twice a day. I kidded him, saying, David, it took you 5 years to figure out something was wrong, which is a good point to reiterate for the listener, a point I discussed on tape one. If your current program hasn't been yielding results for weeks or months, it's not going to start working magically next week. Cease immediately, take a 2 or 3 week layoff, and then resume training with high intensity. David Paul, by the way, put 185 pounds on his squat in 4 weeks and gained 7 pounds of muscle that month.
That's wonderful progress. And what about Dorian Yates?
Dorian is almost a teratological case, Dave, an ultra-gargantuan physique who, like Victor Richards, is so imposing that when he walks into Gold's Gym in Venice, the other bodybuilders, even advanced ones, grit their teeth. They simply can't believe that anyone can attain that much sheer muscle mass. The first time I trained Dorian was in 1992. I ran into him at Gold's Gym, where he told me he was not satisfied with his progress. He had allowed the number of sets he was performing for each body part to creep up to 6. Although he was reluctant to accept my conclusion that he was overtraining, he did allow me to supervise his bicep workout that day. The bicep workout consisted of 1 set of Nautilus curls carried to a point of momentary muscular failure, whereupon I helped him into the contracted position and had him hold it there statically for roughly 15 seconds before lowering under strict control. Dorian didn't say much other than he liked the way it felt and with that left the gym. Thinking the matter was closed, I was surprised to see Dorian the next morning at Gold's eagerly seeking me out. "Mike," he said, "I wouldn't be here talking to you right now, but I swear I woke up this morning and my biceps were bigger from that 1 set yesterday." And with that, Dave, we, Dorian and I, agreed that I'd train him for the next 2 weeks so he could learn the 1 set system and use it when he returned home to England to prepare for the 1993 Mr. Olympia. I trained him on a couple of different occasions after that, but lately he's made it a point to steer clear of me. I suspect he didn't like all the publicity associating him with Mike Mensah. As a multi-Mr. Olympia winner, he is looking to create his own mythology, if you will. And possibly because he found out that it wasn't politically correct to be lauding me in flex and muscle and fitness.
That's too bad.
Well, in a way, perhaps, Dave, but remember, Dorian is his own man and must do what he regards as best for his career. He had been so kind as to endorse my heavy-duty system in my magazine ads, which has helped the cause, and I sure do appreciate it.
To pick up the thread, Mike, where does Steve Bleckman enter the picture?
At the right time. In the early part of 1995, in fact, when I was really starting to grow uncomfortable with the strain between Joe Weider and myself, certain individuals who had contact with Mr. Bleckman began reporting to me that he was interested in having me work for him. I had never heard of the man before and would reply to these people, "Look, if Mr. Bleckman is interested in having me work for him, why doesn't he call me?" And lo and behold, it wasn't long after that I received a phone call. And I'm glad he did call, for we hit it off very well from the outset, and I have no regrets about leaving Weider and signing to work exclusively for Steve and the best magazine on the market, namely All Natural Muscular Development.
Mike, I'm glad to hear you and he are getting along so well.
Yes, he is an interesting, intelligent, as well as a very decent man, Dave. During the first few of those phone calls last year, we each recognized our strong mutuality of values. In addition to being about the same age, both of us have had a lifelong love of bodybuilding, enormous respect for the intellect and science, and a strong desire to advance the bodybuilding industry's future. In fact, Steve sees himself as the man to possibly direct or redirect the future of this sport or industry. He possesses a restless intelligence and exacting standards that demand ever more complex challenges. He also has enormous resources, including time. At the age of 43, Mr. Bleckman is imbued with the cardinal element of youth. He knows that great things are possible and has the audacity to achieve them. And with regard to the Bleckman Brothers Twin Lab Supplement Company, I decided to endorse their Creatine Fuel Plus because it, like the rest of their supplements, is the best on the market. Last year, in 1996, I visited Steve and his brothers at the Twin Lab facility in Ronkonkoma, New York. While I was prepared, Dave, not to be unduly impressed, as I had heard reports from a few others, including John Romano, as to how great an operation Twin Lab truly is, I was still very, very impressed. As Ross Bleckman started me on the cook's tour of the factory and warehouse, I couldn't help but notice the great pride he had in regard to their achievement. And by the time we were halfway through, I saw that his pride was certainly justified. The warehouse is enormous, packed with material and product from the floor to the top of the 35-foot ceiling, much of it on conveyor belts, which keep everything moving all the time so there is never more than 2 days' storage, and thus that the buyer receives fresh quality product, which is their forte. They have so many fail-safe backup systems at every step along the production line to ensure quality. With Twin Lab, you can be certain you're getting what you pay for, as opposed to others in the bodybuilding supplement industry who farm out their products to be produced by others.
I see you've been endorsing Twin Lab's Creatine Fuel Plus. Now, Mike, do you really use it?
Not only do I actually use it, Dave, I practically live on it at times. As busy as I am, there are periods when I don't have time for formal sit-down meals, especially breakfast and lunch. So I drink Creatine Fuel Plus along with Twin Labs egg fuel mixed in non-fat milk periodically through the day, but always have a normal dinner. More recently, I added Twin Labs Sport Fuel Multivitamin Mineral Supplement for the powerful antioxidant properties which help prevent muscle catabolism during high-intensity training, and I've never felt better.
Mike, there was an interesting comment in one of your recent articles in All Natural Muscular Development. You stated that you've mastered bodybuilding science.
To be precise, Dave, I stated that in looking back to when I wrote Heavy Duty 4 years ago, I realized that my level of understanding of the fundamental theoretical principles of bodybuilding science was something on the order of 2 + 2 = 3.5. As a result, my client's progress wasn't as good as it could have been. Now my understanding is the equivalent of 2 + 2 = 4. And that shows up in my clients finally achieving results I always knew were possible. Before, I would only occasionally have someone gain 10 to 20 pounds in a month or 30 to 40 pounds in 3 to 5 months. Now such gains are the rule. When I mention the fact that I have finally mastered the fundamentals of bodybuilding science to someone on the phone recently, he said, "There you go again, posturing, Mensur, always so damn certain. How can you possibly claim such a thing?" And I responded, "Didn't you, sir, master the fundamentals of mathematical science, namely addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division?" "I didn't say," I continued, "that I'm omniscient or infallible, or even that I possess an exhaustive knowledge of exercise science. Give me a break," I continued. "I'm a little slow. It took me over 20 years to master the simple fundamentals of bodybuilding science, and which may be summarized like this. To be productive, exercise must be number one, intense, number two, brief, and number three, infrequent. The fundamentals, in other words, relate to the issues of intensity, volume, and frequency." Now, in stating that I've mastered the fundamentals of bodybuilding science, listener, I can't say necessarily that I would start you or a new client on the same baseline program that the Almighty would, as mentioned on a previous tape. What I do is start the individual on a proven baseline program, one that has worked well for the majority. If after checking his strength increases, once he has completed 2 or 3 cycles of the 4 workouts, I deem his progress is not satisfactory, I make modifications. An important observation I made several years ago, having been a trainer for 2 years at that point, is that those with what I refer to as linear physiques, those with slighter builds, most often individuals 5'10" or taller and 150 to 185 pounds or so, are the ones who usually do not tolerate high-intensity exercise stress quite as well as others. And with those of that body type whose training history already clearly reveals a lower exercise stress tolerance, I start them out on a modified program, which I refer to as the consolidation program.
I understand, Mike, that your new book, Heavy Duty 2, Mind and Body, which is filled with quotes, has a quote from Thomas Jefferson as the first quote of the book.
Yes, and it is perhaps President Jefferson's most famous. He said, "Fix reason firmly in her seat, and call to her tribunal every fact, every opinion. Question with boldness even the existence of a God, because if there is one, he must more approve of the homage of reason than that of blindfolded fear." Close quote. If anyone listening thinks that the material on these tapes is too intellectual, Dave, that perhaps people shouldn't be expected to learn philosophy, remember, bodybuilding does not exist in a vacuum apart from the rest of life. Even within bodybuilding, if one desires to learn to distinguish between true and false ideas, he must learn to reason, and only a rational philosophy can teach that.
This is the end of side one. Please turn over the tape at this point to continue with side two.
Well, now that you've raised the point, Mike, I think it would be appropriate to ask, what is philosophy exactly?
Philosophy, Dave, is the intellectual discipline whose purpose is to study the fundamental nature of things, which then enables the special sciences to study isolated aspects of the universe. Or, one could say that the purpose of philosophy is to teach man to make valid identifications, i.e., establish the identity of the fundamental nature of things. And one may learn to do this only once he has come to understand the 5 branches of philosophy, Dave. Forming the base of philosophy's hierarchical knowledge are metaphysics, which studies the fundamental nature of reality and man, and epistemology, which studies the nature of knowledge and man's means of acquiring it. Logically based on and derived from these two fundamental branches is the third branch, ethics. It is only on the basis of having properly identified the fundamental nature of man, including his means of knowledge, and of the universe in which he acts, that it is possible to formulate a prescription for what man ought to do. Whereas the first two branches are essentially descriptive, ethics is prescriptive. The task of a proper, non-religious, scientific ethics is to teach man, quite simply, to make the right choices. The next step up man's hierarchical structure of knowledge is politics. Its proper function is to identify and implement the principles that serve as a logical transition from guiding a man's actions to guiding his actions with others, and to tie it all together and present man his abstract theoretical philosophy in concretized form for his pleasure and contemplation is aesthetics or art. Everyone listening to this tape has a metaphysics, a view of reality, an epistemology, a view of knowledge, an ethics, a code for making choices, a politics, and an aesthetics, or art values. In short, he has a philosophy. Man needs a philosophy in order to live. The only alternative, Dave, is whether the individual gains his philosophy by chance or by choice. That's all I want to say about the five branches, except that if anyone listening does care, if you don't want to leave the creation of your soul to chance, literally, and that is the issue, then start studying philosophy by reading Ayn Rand's novel, The Fountainhead, and concurrent with reading The Fountainhead, I'd strongly suggest you read her book of explicit philosophical essays entitled Philosophy, Who Needs It?
That sounds almost frightening, leaving the creation of one's own soul to chance.
Well, it shouldn't frighten anyone, although it should have a sobering effect. Most in our culture have, in fact, left the issue of their own souls to chance influences. One soul, Dave, is not some gossamer-like ghostly ethereum lodged in his nervous system. Your soul is your consciousness, which is comprised of two elements, your ideas and your emotions, which are integrated. Your emotions are literally the products of your ideas, your thinking. And most people blindly and uncritically accept their ideas from magazines, books, movies, family, friends, teachers, by osmosis from the cultural atmosphere, as Ayn Rand put it. As a result, many of their ideas or beliefs are contradictory, which is why they are torn by conflict and thus uncertain about so many things. Without philosophy, one cannot critically evaluate ideas, and he perforce becomes a man of mixed premises with a soul like a shapeless piece of clay stamped by footprints going in all directions. With a proper understanding of the power of ideas, that is philosophy, one can achieve an integrated personality, as I described on tape one, where there are no contradictions between a man's thought, feelings, and actions.
Well put, Mike. You know, one of my favorite articles of yours in All Natural Muscular Development had as its theme the issue of concrete-bound bodybuilders versus principled bodybuilders. Now, what in hell does concrete-bound mean?
That's one of my favorite topics as well, Dave. Let me explain how I came to write that piece. I receive phone calls and letters regularly from bodybuilders who are being harassed by others in their gym merely because they are training in a radically different fashion, namely with brief and infrequent high-intensity workouts. They are usually called crazy, and some have even been threatened with physical violence, literally. Dave, there are essentially two types of people in the world, those for whom the mind and knowledge matter enormously, who volitionally choose to work conscientiously and achieve cognitive precision and wide-scale factual integration. Then there are the others, the mentally passive, who decided that the effort required to gain a philosophic, scientific, that is, principled understanding of reality, including their own inner life, wasn't worth the effort. And the mentally passive are the ones who have a penchant for calling my clients crazy or even threatening them with violence. Philosophically, these are referred to as concrete-bound mentalities. They are limited to dealing with the first level of abstraction, that is, concepts that refer to directly perceivable or concrete objects such as chair, table, gym, weights, biceps, etc. When confronted with higher-level abstractions, those not referring to what is directly perceived, such as the concept's theory or principle, they shrink away bewildered. You see, Dave, gaining a thorough, first-hand understanding of higher concepts requires extensive mental effort, of the sort that these individuals have spent most of their lives actively evading. Hence, upon encountering that better type of individual, the one who heartily embraced the effort and responsibility of rational thought and critical judgment, the self-arrested, concrete-bound person feels threatened even to the point where he'll use violence. These are the ones who leave the creation of their souls to chance, as I was discussing previously. Which brings to mind one of my favorite statements from all of literature, and it is from Victor Hugo in his novel Les Miserables. Listen carefully, Dave, and I quote, "They were of those dwarfish natures, which if perchance heated by some sullen fire, easily become monstrous. There are souls which crab-like crawl continually towards darkness, going back in life rather than advancing in it, using what experience they have to increase their deformity, growing worse without ceasing, and becoming steeped more and more thoroughly in an intensifying wickedness." Close quote. The point here is that either one continues to gain knowledge and progress morally, or he does not, and goes backward. There is no such thing, Dave, as standing still in human life, or stagnating. Either you move forward or backward.
Yes, I'm sure we have all heard something to that effect earlier in our life.
Yes, and it is an important concept for bodybuilders who desire to mature properly to consider. While the degree one can train to stimulate the growth of larger muscles, of course, is strictly limited, there is no limit to how much knowledge one can integrate, as human knowledge is an open-ended hierarchy. A philosophically motivated individual has the capacity to gain knowledge, to develop intellectually from his first moment of cognizant awareness to his last dying breath.
Mike, just to switch gears here for a moment, I understand that one of your recent articles in Muscular Development angered a number of people. I believe it was your report on the Night of the Champions contest.
Yes, it did, Dave. It did anger some people. So far, three different individuals have contacted me in protest of what I said about them in that article. One of those three threatened me physically, a severely self-arrested, concrete-bound individual. As I was leaving Gold's Gym after my own workout, this particular person confronted me, screaming maniacally. Then he started pushing me, saying that I attacked him personally in that article, and that he wanted to go outside and beat me up. I told him that if he touched me one more time, I'd make sure he would spend some time in jail, and that it was a free country, so I could write anything I chose short of libel. By then, the employees from behind the front desk were there to pull him off me, at which point he was still railing on and on, something to the effect that I was a horrible writer anyway, and that he'd get me back somehow. In fact, I said nothing about his moral worth or person in that article, Dave. I merely reported that he wasn't in his best condition for this contest or his last one. Imagine how such an individual might act in a real crisis situation when he has so little self-control in one where there is no real threat. He is in dire need of the type of mind training that a philosophy of reason provides. The day after that incident, I was again leaving the gym when Flex Wheeler piped up, "So, you think I don't know how to train, huh?" Amongst the many glowing things I had written about Flex's physique in that article, I also wrote that neither he nor Ron Coleman had the slightest clue as how to properly direct their training effort. I walked over to Flex and said, "No, Flex, you really don't know how to train. If I could train you for 6 months, you'd beat Dorian Yates." And that was that, Dave, a more civilized encounter, if you will.
Now, Mike, we don't have much time remaining, and I wanted to ask you some questions I have about heavy duty. For instance, why do you have your clients train so infrequently on a split routine? Isn't it true that if one trains different body parts each workout, he can train more frequently, since the non-worked body part is afforded rest on the day he is working other body parts?
This is a very common belief, but it simply is not true. You are failing to recognize, Dave, that exercise, in addition to having a localized effect on the given muscle being worked, also has a systemic effect. That is, it affects the rest of the physical system. Localized muscle recovery actually is completed fairly quickly, with systemic recovery taking up to 4 days or longer in some cases. Haven't you had a heavy leg workout, say on a Friday, Dave, then intentionally rested all weekend thinking you'd be fully recovered? But instead, you woke up on Monday still generally fatigued? See what I mean?
Yes, indeed, and I have had that experience, and you're right. Now, I see the distinction now very clearly between localized recovery and systemic recovery. Now, my next question has to do with your new ad for Heavy Duty 2 in All Natural Muscular Development, wherein you claim it is possible for an individual to actualize his muscular potential in 1 year. That doesn't seem possible.
Those who know nothing about the scientific principles of high-intensity anaerobic exercise stress physiology not only would think that actualizing one's muscular potential in a year would be impossible, they actually wouldn't know where to begin in projecting how long the actualization of their muscular potential might take. Those utilizing the blind, non-theoretical volume approach to training are continuously fretting as to whether they'll ever achieve their goal of bigger muscles or not, because they know nothing, literally nothing, about the nature of the training stress required to stimulate growth, or that the volume and frequency of weight training exercise must be cautiously regulated. I made the point on one of the other tapes, Dave, that when in possession of a truly valid theory, and beyond that, and just as important, one is making the proper, practical application of the theoretical principles, progress, no matter what the field of endeavor, should be nothing short of spectacular all the time. Remember, the purpose of theoretical knowledge is to serve as a guide for successful human action.
Mike, I don't ever recall seeing you address the issue of steroid use as it relates to heavy-duty training in any of your articles. With the trend away from steroids, I would think that there would be a stampede toward high-intensity training.
Dave, this is one of the most pressing issues in modern bodybuilding, the move away from steroids and their resultant effect on training. But your posing of the question implies a consideration perhaps not generally understood. The reason some bodybuilders have gained muscle with volume training relates to the fact that steroids act primarily as recovery ability enhancers. Were those same bodybuilders to train for 2 hours a day, 6 days a week without steroids, they would begin to lose muscle mass almost immediately. Heavy duty, high intensity training is tailor-made for the non-steroid natural bodybuilder because of the painstaking precaution to properly regulate the volume and frequency of exercise to prevent overtraining. I'd like to warn the neophyte bodybuilder that those outlandish routines you read about in certain muscle magazines, which advocate that you train like the top champs for hours every day, were developed with the explicit understanding that steroid use increases recovery ability or exercise stress tolerance manyfold, yet continue to be promulgated by unscrupulous publishers who refuse to inform their readers, the majority of whom are natural, non-steroid bodybuilders, that the top champs who employ them are drug users. And with steroid use becoming a thing of the past, Steve Bleckman, All Natural Muscular Development magazine, and Twim Lab have picked up the gauntlet by investing in research and product development, which leads the way in providing nutritional supplements that serve as the proper, healthy way to augment muscular development. Those insane marathon workouts do not, cannot, will not yield any results for those with a normal complement of hormones. They don't even work, for Christ's sakes. For many who do take steroids, as innumerable of my phone clients have reported, only those with superior genetics who take steroids make progress while training with the marathon or volume approach. And even they would make much greater progress, of course, if they train properly. The proof of that is my own success with heavy duty, Casey Viators, Aaron Bakers, David Durst, David Pauls, not to mention Dorian Yates, and my hundreds of clients.
What about women, Mike? Does high intensity work for them as well as men?
Yes, because the principles of human physiology, Dave, are just that. The principles of human physiology. They are applicable to all, male, female, black, white, tall, short, young, and old, with some variations, of course. And the primary difference between male-female physiology is the sexual reproductive system. Within the context of lesser testosterone endowment, therefore, it can be inferred that women don't tolerate exercise stress as well as men, though not always. I have worked with naturally mesomorphic women who gain better than some men. My advice to women is to follow the advice in these tapes and the accompanying booklet and start with the baseline workout. Whether the goal is to become a bodybuilder, a fitness competitor or model, or even just develop optimum fitness for personal reasons.
And what about older people?
In fact, high-intensity training is very good for older people, as without some form of weight-bearing stress, older women in particular become prone to osteoporosis, which is demineralizing of the bones. Older people, men and women, also tend to lose lean mass unless they engage in some form of weight training and aerobic exercise. And as you know, the loss of lean mass results in the slowing of the metabolism, which makes it easier to get fat.
I would imagine many like your heavy-duty workouts because they are brief and infrequent.
I have spoken with numerous people, especially intelligent, career-oriented individuals who were either about to give up weight training or were reluctant to start as they were under the impression that training every day for an hour or two was required, and they just couldn't justify, Dave, that kind of time expenditure. Then they read about my approach and only trained for 20 minutes every 4 or 5 days, and now these same people are quite delighted with their progress. What never ceases to amaze me, Dave, is the number of bodybuilders who scoff at the mere suggestion of even trying heavy duty and continue to slave away for hours a day with little in the way of meaningful progress. Throughout human history, men have done all they could to avoid slavery, and here in the latter part of the 20th century, there's a group of knuckleheads who seem to willfully embrace the role of beast of burden.
What about aerobic exercise and cardiorespiratory health?
Dave, aerobics have been inordinately emphasized over the last decade, ever since it was recognized that the public is more likely to engage in low-intensity aerobic activity than in high-intensity anaerobic activity. Some may recall that prior to the heavy emphasis on aerobic conditioning, the primary emphasis was on something called total fitness. Total fitness is comprised of several components, including skeletal muscle strength, flexibility, endurance, the building and maintenance of lean mass and positive self-image, all of which are best achieved through a properly conducted weight training program. Aerobic activity does next to nothing to provide for increased skeletal muscle strength. In fact, by overworking certain few muscles to the exclusion of working others at all, aerobics can create imbalances in the skeletal muscular system, which increases the likelihood of injuries. Nor does aerobic exercise improve flexibility, anaerobic endurance, or lean mass. And it was never cast in stone that one must limit his activity to repetitive movement of the legs as on a treadmill or Stairmaster to improve his cardiorespiratory endurance. The cardinal principle for improving cardiorespiratory fitness is that the individual sustain a certain age-related pulse rate for at least 12 to 20 minutes. This can be easily accomplished with high-intensity training by limiting rest time between sets. Or, if a person is hell-bent on doing aerobics, remember, it is possible to overtrain here, too. When training in high-intensity fashion, as described on tape 2, limit aerobics to no more than 20 to 30 minutes twice a week. And for the bodybuilder who is seeking to develop maximum muscle mass in the shortest time possible, I strongly advise he eliminate aerobics entirely for a while. This is because the body has a strictly limited adaptive capacity. It's not as if the body has 100 units of adaptive resources for increases in strength and size and 100 units available for adapting with increased endurance. The body possesses but 100 units of adaptive energy, period. Or in other words, training guided by mixed premises will not yield results of the same magnitude as would adaptive specific training.
Mike, I see that our time is up. Thank you very much for a most enlightening interview, and I will look forward to talking to you again soon.
Dave, it was my pleasure.
The editors of All Natural Muscular Development are pleased to have been able to bring you these highly informative lectures by Mike Mincer, who writes exclusively for their magazine. Pick up a copy today, or better yet, order your subscription to All Natural Muscular Development at 40% off the newsstand price by calling 1-800-835-2246, extension 500. That's 1-800-835-2246, extension 500. And remember, keep pumping. Mike, I know you've done this many times over during your career, you know, talk about your background and all that, and I think it would be an appropriate place for us to start here. Even though some of those listening have been fans of yours a long time and may know something about your life, there are always new people entering bodybuilding, and I'm sure they would like to know something of your past, anything you consider relevant or important.
You're right, Dave, about people entering this field all the time. As a phone consultant, I receive calls from individuals literally every day who only recently picked up a barbell for the first time, and which augurs well for the future of this industry, by the way. These novitiates usually know little or nothing about mine or the sport's past, and since my life is so intimately bound up in bodybuilding, relating my past may teach them something about the recent and not so recent history of the sport. Dave, I was born on November 15, 1951, in Germantown, a small town outside of Philadelphia. At the age of 2, my family moved to another small town in Pennsylvania, Ephrata, which was and is predominantly a farming community. My dad was the major influence during the first 12 years of my life. Although he wasn't intellectually oriented himself, he went to some lengths to inculcate in me the values of education and knowledge. When I did do well in school, for instance, he would reward me. There was one occasion when I received all A's in my report card, and he gave me a baseball mitt,